against something that will help people who are in desperate need.
Okay. Thank you, Ellie. Okay. Senator Menas.
Mr. Ellie, what exactly is the problem that you're trying to address in this bill? I think what I've heard in terms of objections is the mandated training or teaching.
My problem is that, though, you see, in not finding doctors who are aware that I'm not playing a game to get meds. You know, in the beginning, a long time ago, when the pain wasn't an issue, maybe. But now that my back is broken down, I have arthritis and tendonitis and all the kinds of things that come from 35 years pushing a chair, those are the issues I need to deal with. And the biggest problem is attitudes of the doctors and then whoever they fear. And the story I keep getting, I don't know if anyone here at the desk probably has more to offer to your answer your question, but it's the attitudes that it's not a game, that I'm just trying to get by, I want to live as full as I can. And I think training and education is a part of breaking down that attitude.
Mr. Chairman, kind of follow up. Do you have a concern about a specific specialty or a specific group of physicians?
No, Senator Menas, I would say that the problem is pretty well generalized, and I'm not sure. Maybe Carol here, who might have more experience with people calling or hotline or something. But my experience with going around the state, and I did go to a lot of the pain and symptom management task force hearings around the state, and it was common with people that the problem was the attitude that their doctor didn't, thought they were playing games or was afraid of state regulators. And maybe it was just they're making that up, trying to, to confront the patient in an unhonest way or didn't want to deal with it. But to me, it was the attitudes. And to me, that's education and training.
I guess the question for you, Ellie or Joan, and I guess my question is this. Last session ago, we required lawyers, because they're mandatory reporters for child abuse, to actually attend a CLE so they could determine what child abuse is. And I'm assuming if lawyers don't take that, they'll lose their ability to be a member of the Oregon State Bar. And then a couple of weeks ago, most of us voted on a bill that would require teachers to be culturally competent before they get their teaching license. Could you explain to me why you feel that this issue rises to that similar level?
Certainly, Mr. Chair, Senator Brown. As I said, it's not an underestimate to say that there are thousands of Oregonians who live daily with chronic pain. Pain that could be treated but is not adequately treated. 10 years ago, I had a bill requiring education for physicians who dealt with end-of-life pain. And at that time, the president of the OMA, or chair, or whatever the correct title is, said to me, we will take care of it. We will get our members educated. And there has been a huge movement, not so much from the OMA, but there's been a huge education movement. But we're still facing exactly what Ellie is talking about out there. It's scattered. It's hit or miss. And we can't afford that. If you're someone who is in constant pain and you go to your physician, you have to rely on the fact that they know what they're doing, that they know when to refer you to a pain clinic, that they know what kinds of combinations of drugs. Interestingly enough, a lot of this stuff is not rocket science. I actually don't know if I brought it with me. A booklet that's put out that talks about, in pretty simple language, what people need to do. There are seminars all over the place, but we're still not there. Until we get it required for relicensing, you're still going to have a ton of people who haven't learned the ropes like Ellie has, who haven't learned the right language. I get people all the time who tell me that they are educating their physicians,
Absolutely.
And that's fine for them. It works for them. And maybe for the next patient who comes in with the same diagnosis. But what about the one who has a different twist on things, who has a different combination of things causing pain? They're going to have to go through the years of pain and the years of not being able to function properly until they learn how to work the system. You shouldn't have to know how to work the system to be pain-free in Oregon. You ought to be able to go to a healthcare professional who understands. Now, a lot of healthcare professionals don't want to deal with pain, and that's okay. They don't have to deal with pain. It's going to be their choice. And if they're not dealing with, the amendment, I believe, says, who on an ongoing basis treat patients in chronic or terminal pain. If they're not one of those, they're not going to be taking this. So you're not going to get a lot of the other types of physicians doing it. But unless you require it, unless you put enough of a stick out there, we're not going to move forward, and these people are still going to be out there suffering and causing. We deal this session, we're trying to deal with prescriptive drug costs. And with how many times you can go to the physician and all those kinds of things. We have capitation, all that wonderful stuff out there. Do you know what it costs to keep going to the doctor because they didn't treat you the last time and they didn't treat you the time before that because you're still in pain, because you've been given half a month's supply of the drug instead of a full month's supply because you've got somebody who simply didn't get that basic training that says this is what we need. And if you're not going to treat them, at least let's give them the knowledge so they know when to pass a person on to a pain clinic or to a specialist. Sorry, I thought I was too tired to get passionate today. I guess I was wrong. Carol, why don't you go ahead?
Hello. My name is Carol Mizrek, and I'm the pain management coordinator for the state of Oregon. I'd like to echo some of the things that Senator Dukes and Ellie Jenny have spoken about already here today. We have different reasons in different parts of the state for not being able to get proper pain management. Just as the cardiac patient needs to see a cardiologist to get their problem handled properly, people dealing with chronic pain need to have their disease treated properly. It's not being done throughout the state. We all need to be on the same page at the same time. So we need a commission to develop a criteria so that people are not going to their doctor and being told, I can't give you medicines, I'll make an addict out of you, or they're given 30 pain pills and said, make it last for the whole month. People are not being treated adequately. Chronic pain, if it is treated, we have a great deal of statistics that will show you that if chronic pain sufferers are treated properly, they can maintain good quality of life. That's all these people are asking for, is quality of life, just as all the other people in Oregon are.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Menace.
Oh, sorry. I didn't catch your first name.
Carol.
What effect does the Federal Drug Enforcement Administration have on the attitudes of physicians or the willingness of physicians to prescribe pain medication?
Well, I think that in Oregon, I mean, I'm not sure that the FDA is such a big blockbuster for pain management as it is, first of all, educating physicians as to how to treat, when to refer, and also developing more pain management specialist positions throughout the state, not my positions like mine, but physician comprehensive pain management clinics that deal with pain.
I guess the point I'm getting to, I've got an article up in my office from Newsweek magazine.
Oh, yeah, the OxyContin.
And, you know, they're talking about Vicodin and they're talking about some other one, I forget the name of it. But by implication, physicians are prescribing medications inappropriately. And, I mean, if you read that article, you walk away with a very negative connotation of the use of those particular medications for pain. And just so as you know, I happen to be one of these chronic pain sufferers. And I have, not rheumatoid, but psoriatic arthritis. And so I know what you're talking about. But I also know that my physician has a problem from time to time when you read an article in Newsweek magazine and suddenly there's a national hysteria,
mm-hmm.
you know, that's placed in the minds and hearts of people about the use of certain kinds of drugs or the abuse. Now, I know because I happen to take these certain medications for my pain that it rarely takes the edge off of the pain. It gets you to the point where you can function, but the pain doesn't go away.
Mm-hmm.
And I also know that when you are chronically, you know, suffering from pain, you have a less likelihood of becoming addicted to the drug.
Right.
Because, in fact, the pain doesn't go away. So there's no joy. There's no whoopee in taking this stuff.
Exactly.
It levels it off at the very best. In fact, it can be just the opposite. It can be nauseating because if you happen to take, you know,
too much,
then you get a chronic, and you get a headache,
mm-hmm.
and you're out of control. But I have a sense that physicians, my rheumatologist is very compassionate. I think there's a sense that physicians feel this pressure from DEA, Drug Enforcement Administration, who does regulate, they do regulate mm-hmm. physicians who prescribe these medications, and this national hysteria about drug abuse.
My sense is that the press has run with some of this and made it super sensational. I certainly have seen the 2020 and the Dateline article or news cast about OxyContin. The one thing that I guess I have to say is we can't punish the masses for the sins of the few. Anything can be abused.
Couldn't you say that same thing with respect to this bill as it applies training to all physicians? Or I mean, there are some physicians who are very compassionate. They do understand the pain. They tend to be physicians who work in practices with like rheumatology and oncology and things like that, where they're dealing with cancer patients. It's, in my experience, it's kind of the bumbling general practitioner who has no clue.
Yes, and I just want to say, in instances like this, the rheumatologist and the pain specialist and the endocrinologist and so on and so forth that have taken classes in this type of stuff, they will be grandfathered, or hopefully it's the desire of this commission to have those people grandfathered in, but it is specifically the general practitioner or other physicians throughout the state that may be a little less reluctant to treat pain adequately.
Yeah. Kind of an anecdotal story. Years ago, as a young policeman in Portland, I got a call on a lady who was trying to cut her fingers off. And it was in the old Tamarack apartments in St. John's. And I got there, and this woman drank about most of a fifth of whiskey. And she's trying to saw her fingers off with a serrated knife. And, you know, and interestingly, I'm a young policeman. I committed her to the hospital, thinking that she was depressed and perhaps suicidal. But what I recognized years later, because now I have arthritis, and went through this diagnosis, this prognosis, or this progression of the disease, that there were times when I felt like taking a serrated knife and chopping my fingers off. In fact, I suggested to my doctor that, in fact, why don't you cut them off, because it'll at least take the pain away. And there were times when I laid in bed at night and told my wife, why don't you just shoot me, because the pain's so significant.
Mm-hmm.
And having been in a position where, as a young policeman, where you're all macho and have all this kind of power, I put this woman in a mental facility because, in fact, the problem was chronic pain from arthritis, and she's trying to get through that process. I felt very guilty about that because I didn't, as a policeman, understand what the real problem was. So anybody that thinks arthritic pain is taking a couple of Bayer aspirin and going out and doing your gardening is out of their mind.
You know, there's an analogy that they use that every person in the medical profession should have an incision. I agree with that.
Mr. Chair, Senator Minnis, there is more widespread work being done at the correlation between physical pain and mental pain. These days, and I'm very hopeful that the task force will incorporate some of that into this. We have a mental health professional on the task force that we're creating here just to try to be able to pull some of those pieces together.
Senator Dukes, talk to us about these amendments for a second.
Sure. Some of them, Mr. Chair, are cleanup. We had some groups that wanted in, and so you'll see that physicians' assistants are included in Section 10 of the Dash 4 amendments. Pharmacists are included. Chiropractic physicians are included. These are groups that were not in the bill originally, but they wanted to be included. I know that you'll hear from today from a group that's particularly concerned about getting education, but most of these actually liked the idea and thought that pain management was important enough that they wanted to be included. One of the things we've had struggled with is how to determine which physicians would have the training and which wouldn't. Under our statutes, a physician, an MD is an MD. They're all licensed under one section of ORS, and it does not differentiate between a pediatrician and a coroner. So the way working with legislative counsel, we finally came up with under Section 10, Sub 2, which allows the Board of Medical Examiners in consultation with the Pain Management Commission to determine who has it and who would receive the be required to receive the education and who doesn't. And the guidance we've given them is those physicians who on an ongoing basis treat patients in chronic or terminal pain. The next Section 11 is simply to coordinate. The original bill tied the timing of the pain management education course to the period of licensing, and some healthcare professionals have to renew their license every year and some every 2 years. So you ended up with some healthcare professionals who only had 12 hours in which to complete the mandatory curriculum and some who had 24. So Section 11 is there to make them all uniform and give them all 2 years.
These are your amendments, and
they are
with your work group.
They are, and I was going to say somewhere in here we took out a commission that or a group that didn't have anything to do with this bill, and somehow got in there anyway, and we took them out.
Okay. All right, thank you. And for the record, the executive director of the pharmacists object to being included. So.
They came and said they wanted in. If they want out, we'll take them out, but that's what they said.
Okay.
They came with a formal request.
I'll fix it in the house. Okay, did you want to testify?
I would. My name is Jennifer. I'm not on your list. I apologize. My name is Jennifer Wagner, and I am here today as the executive director of the Lane County Pain Society, soon to become the Oregon Pain Society. Under direct requests throughout the state that we become a statewide organization. The Lane County Pain Society is a multidisciplinary group of licensed or certified professionals that range from physicians to nurses, acupuncturists, massage therapists, chiropractors, pharmacists, who meet monthly for education in Lane County in regard to pain management and pain disorders. In the 2 years that I've run the Lane County Pain Society, we have grown at a tremendous rate and now are averaging between 50 and 60 people attending our meetings every month, with the main focus being a multidisciplinary team tackle on pain conditions such as the one that Ellie talked to you about earlier today. I'm also a member of the Oregon State Board of Nursing, and I'm here today to talk to you in favor of this bill, and that I am continually, on a weekly basis, approached not only by just physicians, but nurses, practitioners of all types, with an overwhelming sense of frustration about their inability to treat these patients in a way that makes them as practitioners happy, but also relieves their patients' pain level. Physicians, particularly general physicians, as Senator Menes mentioned, are coming to me requesting this education, are feeling frustrated that they are taking care of people who just don't seem to get better, who are taking increasingly large amounts of narcotics, and still are not reporting an improvement in their functionability. Certainly, with enough narcotics, your pain level can be numbed and go away, but whether you are contributing to society at that point is questionable. So and just in favor, I'd like you to hear that there are physicians, nurses, licensed people who are seeking this continuing education, who are looking for it in many ways, who are attending on a regular basis to get it, and would like to use this type of format to treat their patients better.
Great. Thank you, Jennifer. Thank you, ladies. Senator. Scott Gallen, Ed Patterson. He's got okay, that's still 16.
Mr. Chairman, for the record, my name is Scott Gallant. I'm with the Oregon Medical Association. And I've done a lot of checking on this bill and what has occurred in the past and where we are today in regard to pain management and what opportunities currently exist without a mandatory continuing education program, which I'll get into in a minute. The association does oppose the bill as it is currently drafted, including the -4 amendments, which I'll be happy to get into in a minute. There was a time many years ago, over 10 years ago, and I believe Senator Minnis, then Representative Minnis at the time, was involved in amending the Board of Medical Examiner statute in regard to appropriate treatment for chronic pain. There were then, and the Medical Association heard many complaints from practicing physicians that they were exceedingly concerned about potentially being disciplined by the Board of Medical Examiners because of if they prescribed serious medications to deal with these conditions. And in fact, we ultimately worked with the board to resolve those issues, and the issue has continued over the period of time, not only for chronic pain management, but as well as end-of-life care. I believe the committee has received a letter from the Board of Medical Examiners opposing the legislation. But it makes two very important points. First of all, the board has made a serious commitment to assisting physicians in understanding what their standards are in regard to potential disciplinary action or not acting in a disciplinary manner through the use of their medical director. And they do two courses a year in regard to pain management today. I think it should also be recognized that the Oregon Health Sciences University has, in fact, been, as the letter says, a leader in the field of pain and symptom management, and they have integrated in their curriculum courses on appropriate pain management for patients. All of these things actually have been in response to what has been a national trend, not only in Oregon, but throughout the country. Just an easy search on OHSU's webpage shows you that there are any number of courses and programs that physicians and others may take in regard to proper pain management. As you know, OHSU has a pain management center. It also has a geriatric center as well. And just reviewing the literature, there are courses and programs from the Department of Neurology on appropriate management of complicated patients with pain. There's been a recent program for physicians who specialize in the treatment of elderly patients on appropriate treatment of pain. For example, this August 21st, there'll be a Summer Institute Oregon Geriatric Education Center dealing with the overview of symptom management and advanced disease. medication issues and pain management, et cetera, and it goes on and on. Personally, on the national level, I helped motivate the American Medical Association in putting together a comprehensive program on the treatment of end-of-life care, including pain management, for those particular patients. The Medical Association felt that was an important thing for the AMA to do, and they have done that. One thing you need to appreciate for patients who have medications prescribed to them that are narcotics, those patients will develop a tolerance for those medications, and the dosage will be increased over the course of time because of the tolerance that those patients will receive. The bill, at least as it was originally drafted and as it was at least initially proposed to be amended, would have included all physicians, whether or not they treat patients with chronic pain at all. And obviously the new -4 amendments, which were just presented today, apparently tries to make a distinction. What subsection 2 of section 10 on line 17 through 21 essentially do is it says that a physician, that the Board of Medical Examiners would have to identify physicians who treat patients in chronic or terminal pain, and who must complete one pain management education program established, et cetera, as a matter of licensure. So it doesn't say how many patients you might have or whether or not you appropriately refer a patient or not. It doesn't recognize that most physicians under national medical specialty societies go through continuing education on a variety of things, including neurosurgeons.
Senator Brown.
Are doctors required to take continuing education?
Under Oregon law, they are not required to take continuing education.
Okay. Okay.
There are a series of studies that indicate that mandatory continuing education is not particularly successful.
Mr. Chair.
Including for attorneys.
Scott, I realize that for attorneys it's not particularly effective, but I do it because I'm required to do it.
And I understand that.
When the legislature passed the bill requiring me to go get trained so I can recognize child abuse, I'm more than happy to go spend my hour doing that. How else are we going to make doctors do this if we don't require them to do it?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Brown, first of all, you have to make an assumption that physicians who treat patients with chronic pain, in fact, are practicing below the standard of care, and I don't believe that is, in fact, the case. There's a recent study by Susan Toll at OHSU that has suggested that Oregon physicians are well ahead of their colleagues nationally in treating pain of patients with terminal illnesses, which I think is a very positive thing. I have not seen any evidence other than anecdotal comments that physicians, in fact, are treating patients below the standard of care.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
More?
Mr. Chair, I'm Ed Patterson, representing the Oregon Association of Hospitals and Health Systems, and I'm here to support what Scott has been telling you regarding the attitude of the Oregon Medical Association, and that also reflects the attitude of the Oregon Association of Hospitals. The bill, as it is currently written, includes not only doctors, but all nurses and all dentists who are licensed by the state, and Scott has heard today from two representatives from the Oregon Nurse Association that they do not support the bill either. And you heard, I guess, over the din in the background that the pharmacists do not support being added also. I think the reason for that is that, in large part, credit is due to Senator Dukes, who has been on this campaign for at least 10 years that I'm aware of, who has made the issue has bubbled to the top. I think the debate on death with dignity that we've had here in the past few years has made the issue an important issue publicly and in the minds of legislators. Last session, there was a task force that was appointed that met, was a rather large task force that met on an ongoing basis, a legislative task force on an ongoing basis, and it's interesting to note that in the final recommendation that task force made, they did not include a recommendation to tie continuing education to licensure in terms of pain management education. I think that's an interesting note after these experts met for over a year that they did not make that recommendation. Our concern is that we have made a lot of progress, I think, as a medical community, particularly in the state that I'm mostly familiar with. And it seems to me that this bill goes way beyond what is necessary now. It could have been maybe of more value 10 years ago than it is now, but we have made a lot of progress, as you've indicated. You'll also note in one of the papers that was handed out by Senator Dukes and this one here, it says in that paper that hospital accreditation is now tied to assessing pain management within the hospital, and a hospital can lose its licensure or his accreditation unless they have an ongoing program, and that's a fairly new program. It's just begun in a requirement of making that a requirement of hospitals. So it seems to me like we have made a lot of progress. We're going to continue to make progress. And our big concern is the way this bill is constructed in terms of tying the whole issue of pain management to the education and licensure. As an example, Scott talked about the doctors. I know the amendment takes the doctors out and only speaks to a specific type of doctor who practices chronic pain management. But it leaves nurses in, as an example. All 35,000 nurses in the state, regardless of whether they are into pain management or not, would be required to have this continuing education. Half of those 35,000, about 17,000 or 18,000 of those nurses, work for hospitals. And I have to tell you that in hospitals, not every RN, not every nurse, deals with direct patient care. We have nurses in nursing administration. We have nurses doing many other functions in hospitals. They have nothing to do with individual direct patient care. Many nurses are doing quality assessment in hospitals. There are careers opening up all over the place in the insurance industry for nurses that evaluate insurance claims. It had nothing to do with pain management. So it's that kind of an approach that I think is probably inappropriate to tie it to licensure. So, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, we would hope that, and I have not had an opportunity to look over the Dash 4 amendments, I'm not exactly what they do, but we would hope that we would think a little longer about this as a new state policy. And remember that we're making great strides in terms of pain management in our community, healthcare community now, and this may not be a timely bill at this point. Mr. Chair, we would oppose the measure also.
Thank you. Clarification, dentists are out of the Dash 4s, and Tom Holt put a note saying the pharmacist has not at any time advocated for this legislation, not that they're necessarily opposed, so for the record. Okay. All right, thank you, gentlemen.
Mr. Chair, just for the record, my understanding is that Senator Dukes did believe that the pharmacist did want in the bill, which is why they were put in. I think they can easily be taken out of the bill.
Okay. All right, we're in work session. Where are you guys on this one?
Chair, I'll move the Dash 4 amendments.
Okay. All right, Senator Brown moves the Dash 4 amendments, Senate Bill 885. Discussion.
Mr. Chair. Just a comment. While I appreciate the comments that were made by Mr. Gallant and Ed, my perception is a reality, having dealt with a lot of my family members that they're getting older and dealing with these pain issues recently, is that many of the physicians and other practitioners could use a dose of training on pain management, that it's a good thing, not a bad thing. And I think this brings to point some necessary training. My perception is that most professionals in the business do not find the idea of pain management really exciting stuff in their profession. There are many other things. I'm not trying to downgrade the quality of their care, but I think this is something that when you're hurt, the basic thing you're looking for is someone to help you with pain that doesn't hurt them to have to take a class once or twice every couple of years.
Okay. No objections to the amendment. Dash 4 carries.
Mr. Chair, I move the bill as amended to the Senate floor with the DuPass recommendation.
Senator Brown moves Senate Bill 885 to the floor with the DuPass recommendation as amended. Any further discussion? Objection? Hearing none, so ordered. Senator Dukes, you going to carry this thing?
Yes, sir.
Okay. All right, closed session. Okay, I tell you what we're going to have to do is we'll go to 35, Representative Morissette. 26, 27 real fast, and we'll go into 35, 28, and that's going to be all we're going to get today, and we'll just put this at the top of the queue Thursday, so sorry about that. All right, open work session. House Bill 26, 27.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members of the committee, my name is Bill Morissette, representative from District 42, and I'm here today with a good bill, House Bill 2627, and this permits practitioners authorized to prescribe drugs to use electronically transmitted prescriptions. It's permissive in its nature. It simply adds that to the written and oral transmission of prescriptions. The piece that you are receiving is interesting. During our field trip during the summer in June, we visited the Joint Health and Human Services Committee, visited a fully automated clinic in Burns, built in 1998, and is the fully electronic clinic. Sits adjacent to the Harney District Hospital. Computers are located in each exam room, the doctor's office, the nurse's station, and so on. Local pharmacists are connected to the system and receive prescription electronically. The clinic reports to be nearly paperless. Now, the purpose of this bill is simply to get this going. It doesn't require anything, but I would like to come back next session and talk more about medical errors and how errors can be avoided by using electronic
We'll talk about that
devices.
Next session, so this works pretty good. It's good for Burns, it's good for the state.
It's good for Burns, it's good for the state, absolutely.
We've got some Dash 2's conflict amendment, Senator Minnis.
Aye.
Conflict amendment?
Aye.
Senator Cornyn.
Mr. Chair, I move the Dash 2 amendments to House Bill 2627, please.
Senator Cornyn moves the Dash 2 amendments to House Bill 2627. Further discussion, objection, hearing none. The order.
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 2627 as amended to the Senate floor with a DuPass recommendation.
Senator Cornyn moves House Bill 2627 to the floor with a DuPass recommendation as amended. Discussion, objection, hearing none, so ordered.
Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Morissette. Senator Byer, would you like to carry this?
Sure.
You've been pretty quiet over there. Closed work session. Open work session, House Bill 3528.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I'm Tom Butler from House District 60. I'm a sponsor of House Bill 3528, and I'm glad to be here today with some folks from our district, former County Judge Dale White and current County Judge Stephen Grasty, as well as Jet Blackburn. I just by way of introduction, this is an issue regarding what we call the Narrows. It's on the state map. You'll find it on the state map. Even though the actual Narrows was washed out years ago, this is a bill which passed the House, has come to you after a great deal of consternation, and I don't know why, because it passed out of committee in pretty good shape originally, and then was called back and went through a second committee. I will call your attention to some issues that are of concern to me. There's been a hit campaign on this from time to time. I just want to call the current hit and slurs something of an outrageous bunch of information and drivel that's been passed out from a group of environmental extremists who do not have their facts correct and have actually sent out emails over the weekend and as late as today asking you to disguise or asking their members to disguise themselves and their identities, to not identify themselves with their environmental group and to express their dissatisfaction with the bill. With many misrepresentations, and that's most unfortunate. I find that
It's difficult for me to come before you and ask for a building permit as it is for something that's been lost or destroyed. But one item of misinformation is that this particular campground that needs to be updated in the southern part of Harney County is very, very site-specific, and I'll let Judge White and Jet Blackburn and perhaps Judge Grassy refer to it. They're the people that were involved in this. It was built legally by honorable people, and they are people who anticipate the 4,000-plus cyclists and members of Cycle Oregon to be in this particular portion of Oregon, and also the new elevated heights of understanding of what there is in the Steens Mountains brings this to our attention today. So I again want to express my reservation over these hit campaigns that there's really not much room for them, but I come before you today with a group of people who I can subscribe to you that they are honest and honorable people, have served in the county and in their communities for many, many years. Do not bring to you something that they have illegally done, as has been purported in one of the hit pieces, as I say, that's come out, which is just drivel as far as I'm concerned. So with that, to explain the true meaning, I'd like to go ahead and have former Judge Dale White explain to you what this particular House bill does. Again, I want to tell you that I wholeheartedly support it. You've talked about other things that benefit the economically depressed area of southeastern Oregon. We can't farm, we can't build homes, we can't add to our businesses, and so we're told to rely further and more upon issues dealing with tourism, and then we go and try and attract the tourists, and we're told just as long as you don't do it so that they can be accommodated. One other item that I felt was really interesting, and one of the hit pieces that I'd received during this process, was a statement that said that the hardy folks of southeastern Oregon can certainly hold it for 62 miles. And I'm not those people who would vote against a bill, who would put in a restroom and a gas station and those kinds of things. Those people who would vote against them. This is a loop down around the Steens, which is a couple of hundred miles round trip, with very limited resources, very limited places to get gas, very limited places to have public restrooms. That's why that part of this bill went through the Health and Water Environment Committee. But in that process, it's not inconceivable that people would be a few hundred miles figuring that there was going to be a gas station before they could really come to the Narrows. So with that,
Thank you, Representative Butler, Ken Snyder, Jerry Sutherland, Mike Lohmeyer, is that right? Kohmeyer.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, thank you for taking the time to let me express my views on this bill. My name is Ken Snyder. I'm a lifelong resident of Oregon. I'm born here and have remained here all my life. And there's a couple of reasons why I'm here and why a resident of Clackamas County would be concerned about a proposed development or development in Harney County. And one of those reasons is, first of all, it's a statewide issue. This is a land use issue under Oregon State Land Use Laws Administrative Rules. So I, as an Oregonian, have an interest in making sure that the laws that we pass make sense and they do the right thing for the people of the state of Oregon. The second is that I recreate in that part of the state. I enjoy it out there. It is a total contrast from what we have here in the valley. It's refreshing to get away from sometimes the soggy weather and the wetness that we have. and the trees and the mountains, and go to a place that is wide open, where you can see the sky, where it's clear a lot of the time, where the weather is fair during the spring and summer and early fall months, and enjoy it. And so I'm concerned about what happens there in terms of my experience in going to that part of the state and recreating. The Steens Cooperative Act was put together by a very delicate balance of ranchers and landowners, the environmental community, and our state, our federal representatives, to make this happen. And one of the things that people agreed on right off the bat was we don't want to attract a lot of people, and that's why we didn't name it a national monument or a conservation area or a park. It was a low-key name to keep its profile low for the general public. People who want to find it can find it, but it won't be on a gazetteer or a guide as a destination. And what I'm concerned with is that sort of development will bring people there that people who live around there don't want to have a lot of people there, and it provides them an opportunity. Another thing is that I don't think this really does much for economic development for Harney County. There may be, I think, 3 to 9 jobs added, which is 3 to 9 jobs they didn't have before. But I would think that the city of Burns would be more interested in trying to develop much more broad-based, sustaining family wage jobs that would help replace some of those natural resource jobs that have gone away. And by using the telecom system that they have in Burns with that huge pipeline from the state of Oregon, there's a huge opportunity for them to develop incubator e-businesses.
Have you been to Burns recently?
Yes, I have.
You know what 9 jobs means to Burns?
I understand it means a lot to each one of those people that has a job.
Do you have a job now?
Yes, I do. Okay. And I've been unemployed for months at a time. I used to be in construction. I understand that feeling. It's scary. But to take a broader look and a larger plan, the whole picture of how to develop that Steens area and where it makes sense and what we have. The other thing is that this is another public convenience that would be on the west side of the Steens on a route that goes to already existing and functioning businesses at Steens Mountain Resort and French Glen, and would put more stress on that on those folks down there. If we need public conveniences, it is on the east side of the Steens along the Foley Farm Road there next to the Albert Desert. There's only one public convenience for 100 miles between Fields and Burns Junction. That's where we need a public convenience. And also I'm concerned about what's going to happen to the folks in French Glen. I can see a sign war starting where the folks in French Glen need to get a sign in front of the Narrows sign so that they won't just think that the Narrows is the only thing there. And then the Narrows is going to have a sign in front of their sign to let them know that the Narrows is there too. And it could escalate, and the signage could be a problem there too. With that, I will close. Thank you.
I got to ask you a question.
Sure.
Do the people from southeastern Oregon come over to Milwaukee and tell you how to live in your neighborhood?
They do through state law.
Well, and that's why we're here. So I'm looking at a desolate little location in the middle of what Governor Goldschmidt said was the middle of nowhere. Now, how is this a problem? Somebody point to me. What's the problem here? This is
the problem, in my opinion, is that simply this was a development that is looking for something to do. And I don't know why it was developed.
You want to see development. Come out to East Multnomah County.
Well, we're not talking about the same sorts of rural territory. This is on farmland.
Looks like sagebrush.
It's zoned farmland.
Maybe we've got a different problem.
Mm-hmm. Yes, sir.
How much can you grow here?
I don't know. I'm not a farmer.
Okay, thank you. Senator Miller.
I was struck by some of the conflicts we get in this committee, and I'm thinking of the bill we had in here in our last meeting where the city wanted to keep us out of judging things they wanted to judge and said, you know, local control is a pretty good thing, and you state types ought to keep your nose out. We know how to run our community, and I think some people adhere to that advice and some don't, but I take it from your testimony you don't trust the locals to know what's best for them.
I think on the local level there are a lot of pressures that are evident in the political life and the economic life of a community that can affect decisions and not necessarily reflect the long-term interests of all the people that are there.
In other words, they can't be trusted?
They can be trusted, but they also have to be verified. As Ronald Reagan said, trust but verify. There has to be a way to make sure that they're not violating existing state law or other things that would be detrimental to the people of the state of Oregon at large.
So those who live within the crammed urban areas are the best judges of what life should be like out on the outskirts of the state? Is that your view?
No, that's not my view. I think the people who live in rural areas and isolated communities do a lot of things for the folks in the urban environment as well. We have to depend on each other. We buy our food from them. We buy other services that are produced the natural resource base that we have here. But I think that there has to be some way to make sure that the needs of the few don't step over the needs of the many.
Are you aware?
The many being our desire to leave the populated areas and go to these desolate areas, we want to make sure that nobody messes with that ground.
No, I think that it has to be used in a wise way that's sustaining, that doesn't deteriorate the natural resource base
and
that's there.
And as to what the wise way is, apparently needs to come from us and not from them.
That's a great philosophical discussion. I don't know if we can ever talk about it, but I think that at the state level.
Get a handle on your view, and it sounds like you are totally uncomfortable with what locals may decide is needed for their employment base or for any of their considered development. If the people of the Portland area don't like it, then they just need to quit thinking about it.
Well, no, I think that they do a lot of things on the local level that don't rise to the level of a concern to someone who lives in the city. But in this particular case, it does have an effect. It is an obvious spot on a landscape that wasn't there before, and it changes what people's experience is when they travel down that road.
I guess I just observed, Mr. Chairman, I happened to fly over a lot of this state last night, and it was pretty easy to observe that 97% of the landmass of this state is uninhabited. And this doesn't strike me as a serious invasion into that equation. I mean, there's an awful lot of area you can go and see stars and see nothing in this state. And I don't think this poses a serious threat.
Then I think we'll have to agree to disagree.
Who's next? Who wants to leap into this thing?
Chair Harper, members of the committee, my name is Jerry Sutherland. I'm from Portland, and I'm a member and volunteer with the Oregon chapter of the Sierra Club and here to speak against Hospital 3528.
Did you emphasize the volunteer aspect for us?
I'm hoping the rocks won't be quite as hard. The reason that we're taking a position against House Bill 3528 is because we feel like it's pretty much harmful and unnecessary legislation. It benefits one developer and protects him from accountability for violations in the construction of the project called the Narrows.
Okay, just a second. Could you vacate, please, Judge Grassley? What violations? Let's get through this. What are the violations?
Reading from the minimum standards applicable to the schedule of permitted and conditional uses on campgrounds, OAR 660-033-0130. A campground can be established on a site that is or contiguous to lands with a park or other outdoor natural amenity that is accessible for recreational use. On the maps that I have submitted to you, Chair Harper, and members, it shows clearly that the property is 2 to 3 miles from the Malheur Wildlife Refuge.
Excuse me, you got a comment?
Well, I haven't reviewed this, of course, but looking at it,
on the spot, but
I can tell you that the bulk of the people, including myself, that either come to or live in Harney County, want to recreate in Harney County. They don't come and say, over there, 2 miles. They're talking about right here. As a matter of fact, in the 70s, I can remember stopping along this road at this location and picking up arrowheads, bringing people I'd never seen before or friends who had never been in the country. Walk around, you could find an arrowhead every time, and you could find agates on this site. So
I think it fits where people would recreate.
You don't want to go to Clackamas for your recreation?
No. Sometimes.
Okay. Yeah, that's just when I need a loaf of bread, yeah. Okay. Go ahead, Jerry.
Thank you, Chair Harper. The next requirement is that the campground be integrated into the rural agricultural and forest environment in a manner that protects the natural amenities of the site and provides buffers of existing native trees and vegetation or other natural features between campsites.
How many natural trees do we see here?
Chair Harper, I would say there is sagebrush. The intent of this, I would assume, is that whatever is naturally there be used as buffers between the campsites.
Looks like it's surrounded by sagebrush to me. Okay, keep going.
Campgrounds authorized by this rule shall not include intensely developed recreational uses such as swimming pools, tennis courts, retail stores, or gas stations. In the pictures, I think you'll see that there is an advertisement and existence of a restaurant, full service, breakfast, lunch, and dinner, with a Minute Mart grocery store attached and a gift shop, which would certainly, in my sense, be called a retail store. Campsites may be occupied by a tent, travel trailer, yurt, or recreational vehicle. Separate sewer, water, or electric service hookups shall not be provided to individual campsites, except that they can be unless they're yurts, which these certainly aren't. So it's obvious from your photographs, Chair Harper, that that they do have individual hookups. They are not operating, but this doesn't put that qualification as part of the requirements under the regulations.
Okay. Good. Thank you. Mike?
Chair Harper, members of the committee, my name is Mike Comar, and I'm speaking on behalf of 1,000 Friends of Oregon. I have submitted written testimony, and I will read that and briefly summarize it. 1,000 Friends of Oregon is opposed to House Bill 3528 for roughly three reasons. We believe that it would allow unlimited commercial, industrial, and residential development on very specific land in rural Oregon. It is currently zoned for exclusive farm use, and as such violates Oregon's fundamental policy concerning the preservation of agricultural land for agricultural purposes. Second, this bill would result in spot zoning, which we believe is bad policy and bad law. Zoning decisions should be made by the local government. And in this case, the local government has made a zoning decision, and this, I believe, would overturn the decision that Harney County has made, which leads to the third point, and that is that people think that this would legalize development that is inconsistent with the approval that has been granted by the local government. And I believe you have a packet that includes a variety of documents. The documents include a proposal from the landowner, a response to that proposal by the Department of Land Conservation and Development, and accompanying that letter is an excerpt from the OAR that was just referred to by the previous witness. And then the decision by the Harney County Planning Commission. And the decision by the Harney County Planning Commission indicates that they were approving water, electricity, and sewage dump, but not to individual campsites. And they were also approving a building that would include bathroom, shower facilities, laundry facilities, and lunch counter supply area and storage facilities. And I believe the full-fledged restaurant and gift shop and mini mart is inconsistent with the approval granted by the county, and they were authorizing an administrative building that would include a limited amount of space for a lunch counter and supply area. The decision by the local government was the result of an agreement between various parties that had appealed an earlier decision in Kearney County to the Land Use Board of Appeals. And as a result of the appeal of the earlier decision, the parties to that appeal, to include the applicant and landowner, agreed that what would be developed on that site would be a campground consistent with the Oregon administrative rules concerning campgrounds on the FU land. You can judge for yourself whether you believe that what has now been developed at that site is consistent with the OAR. We believe that it is not.
Thank you, gentlemen. Thank you, Steve. I'll leave you guys with just a thought, not that it matters. You won't let us cut timber. So we can't cut timber. So all of my families are on welfare, out of work, scrambling to make a living to feed their children. You won't let us plant potatoes in the Klamath Basin. So all of my families in the Klamath Basin are out of work on welfare, scrambling to feed their children. So we're going to try and diversify a little bit into tourism. Let's ask somebody from Clackamas to come visit us so we can feed our children. You won't even let us do that. What are you going to let us do besides just go away, which seems to me to be the underlying theme here? So, Chair moves 3528 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Any further discussion? Any objection? Lee, you okay with this?
I'm bothered by the bill, but I wish, frankly, I think the appropriate channel should have been that when the county applied for the land use zone, it should have went through.
Okay, no objections. Hearing done, so all right. Close work session with that.
You got to carry.
I'll carry. With that, we're adjourned. Thank you, gentlemen, ladies.